John chapter 2, verses 13 to 22. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there. And, making a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen. And he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. And he told those who sold the pigeons, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade." His disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So the Jews said to him, "What sign do you show us for doing these things?" Jesus answered them, "Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up." The Jews then said, "It has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days?" But he was speaking about the temple of his body. When therefore he was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken.
Thank you, Sian. Thank you, Marcus. No one has the right to tell me what to do. That's the phrase I put on the top of those white sheets. I wonder if you've actually spoken those words. There'll be some people here who have contact with teenagers day to day, and perhaps you actually hear those words literally spoken every day. No one has the right to tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And those words express something of the theme tune of our age. Now, this question of whether there is such a thing as legitimate authority, the right to tell someone else what to do, seems to be a very complex and complicated one in our society. So at an international level, this is the question which is being discussed recently in relation to Libya, isn't it? When can a nation legitimately intervene in another sovereign state, and on what basis? Or on a personal level, what right does any individual have to tell another individual how they ought to live? So clearly I'm able to tell my children what to do because I'm bigger than them. But is there any legitimacy in it? Do I have any right to control their behaviour? Or is it any attempt to assert authority over another human being simply power play and bullying? Can there be such a thing as a legitimate authority? And who, if anyone, has the right then to tell me what to do? Now, we've been looking together this year through John's Gospel. And last time we looked at it, which I think was back in February, we looked at the previous passage to this one. And in that passage, Jesus Christ was portrayed as the all-providing bridegroom, the one who passionately loves and cares for his people. And it's a lovely portrait, which I take it all of us immediately warm to that picture of Jesus. But today, right next to it, John shows us a very different side to Jesus Christ, an interfering side. So here we see a portrait of one who immediately jars with all of our society's sensibilities. One who doesn't show infinite tolerance and infinite indifference to other people's behaviour, but one who wades in to other people's business uninvited. Now, C.S. Lewis speaks for lots of us, I think, when he says, "No word in my vocabulary expressed deeper hatred than the word interference. And the Bible placed at the centre what seemed to me a transcendental interferer." And I think that's a very apt description of Jesus from this passage we've just had read. The transcendental interferer. But what we're going to see is that not only that Jesus uniquely has legitimate authority to interfere in human affairs, but also that his interference in this world is wonderfully good news. Now, we're going to look at the incident in Jesus' life under two main headings, which I've put there on the sheet. So first, let's consider there the Son demands true worship. Let me read from verse 13. The Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. In the temple, he found those who were selling oxen and sheep and pigeons, and the money changers sitting there, and making a whip of cords. He drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and oxen, and he poured out the coins of the money changers and overturned their tables. So we're told there, right at the start, that it's Passover. It's a frantically busy time. In fact, thousands of people would have just flooded into Jerusalem. The ancient historian Josephus tells us that at Passover in 1 year, 255,000 lambs were bought and sacrificed in the temple courts. So there would have been animals absolutely everywhere. And people swarming in from all over the Near East with lots of different currencies. So in order to pay the temple tax, they would have had to have been money changers everywhere to convert their currency for them. I'm not sure what our closest modern equivalents would be of this kind of event. Perhaps, I don't know if anyone went down the Mall on Friday, but that kind of swarming picture of vast numbers of people. Or perhaps when you see on TV the crowds in Mecca at the time of the Hajj pilgrimage, to give you an idea. Or perhaps closer to home for some people here. Imagine how tumultuous and loud and confusing the trading floors are in some of these big banks. And then add livestock. And we get this enormous sense of a throng of people and animals absolutely everywhere. And into the midst of this very public situation, Jesus strides in. And he starts cracking a whip and throwing the furniture over, and he's yelling, "Get out of here!" Verse 16, "Take these things away. Do not make my father's house a house of trade." Now, can you imagine the scene? That's important for us to see just what it is that Jesus is getting so upset about. So the problem here isn't the activities themselves. Say, selling money, converting currency, all of that sort of trading is necessary for Passover to function. And I'm sure some here will be reassured to know that trading isn't wrong. No, the problem is where all of this is happening. So this is the temple. This is God's house. This is the place that God had chosen where people could go and meet with him and offer him true worship. And it's been converted into a shopping mall. And did you notice just how personal this is for Jesus? He says, "My Father's house." Jesus is revealing publicly that he is God's son. And he's furious about how his father is being dishonored. That instead of the solemn dignity and the murmur of prayer, there's the bellowing of cattle and the bleating of sheep. Instead of brokenness, instead of contrition and holy adoration and prolonged petition, there's all this noisy commerce, and Jesus will not have it. Now, it's worth, I think, at this stage, raising this issue of Jesus' anger. So we often wonder, is it wrong to be angry, or has Jesus lost his temper here? And if it's not wrong, are we therefore justified in letting out our anger a bit more than we do? So I think a helpful verse for me on this is Ephesians chapter 4, verse 26, where Paul tells the Ephesian Christians, "In your anger, do not sin. Do not let the sun go down while you're still angry." And that verse both allows for the fact that there is such a thing as righteous anger. For example, when God is not honored, that should make us angry, as it does for Jesus in this example. But it also warns us that even our righteous anger can and very often does lead us into sin. And we need especially to be careful to avoid that. And in all cases, the verse says, we mustn't go to bed angry. We mustn't let anger stew. Now, it often takes a while after you meet someone to find out what it is that really drives a person, what really makes a person tick. But often it comes out unexpectedly when you see what it is that really gets a person going, what really ignites them and fires them up. And this incident displays for us, as I put there on the sheets, Jesus' consuming passion. Verse 17. Jesus' disciples remembered that it was written, "Zeal for your house will consume me." So that's actually a quotation from the Jewish scriptures, from Psalm 69. And so as all of this was going on, Jesus' disciples saw Jesus acting in this passionate way. And it triggered a connection in their minds to King David, the one whose consuming passion in this psalm is for God's house and for true worship of God. And they see that this is the heartbeat of Jesus Christ. So we're seeing right at the start of Jesus' public ministry what really drives all of his actions at a heart level. And the answer is proper worship and glory and honour of God himself. Later in chapter 4, Jesus says that God the Father is seeking true worshippers to worship him. And this would be a great summary of why it is that Jesus has come. His great passion, his mission, is to gather true worshippers for the Father. And you see, Jesus will not tolerate false worship. He will not tolerate idolatrous worship of anyone or anything other than the true Creator God, his Father. And nor will he tolerate, as in this incident, compromised or half-hearted worship of God. He will not tolerate anything which gets in the way of our full devotion to our Creator. That is his consuming passion. I wonder if you've begun to understand this about Jesus Christ. So every age attempts to recast Jesus in our own image. And lots of modern depictions that you see of Jesus paint him as a kind of ultra-mild, peace-loving hippie. And he looks like he could be the fourth member of the Bee Gees with these long flowing locks. And he doesn't seem to stand for anything in particular apart from infinite tolerance, which is, of course, the spirit of our age. But do you see, that is not the picture we get of Jesus here in the Bible. So here we see a Jesus who is utterly committed to the reformation or eradication of all false and all half-hearted worship in this world. And that includes in you and in me. He hates God being dishonored. So I wonder what kinds of compromised worship Jesus is opposed to in our lives here at the Barge. So perhaps there are situations where outwardly we're still at the temple, we're still very busy for God maybe, but inwardly our cherished ambitions or priorities have really replaced God in our affections, and where that kind of radical worship of God for God's sake, just because he's worthy, that's somehow been left behind or squeezed out in our thinking. So if we're honest, what is really driving the big decisions in our lives about where to be, about what to do in life? Is it really how we can best worship and glorify our great Creator and Saviour? Or does some other factor tend to relegate that one down the list a bit? What is really driving our behaviour at a day-to-day level? So I wonder, one question I ask myself is, what makes this a good or a bad week for me? And what criterion, what am I using when I make that assessment to find out what kind of a week it's been? Is my highest concern whether my God and Father is pleased with how I've lived this week? Is that what makes a good week for me? Or is it some other person's approval or opinion which really determines whether it's been a good or a bad week, whether we've been found attractive or funny by someone else, or whether we've been rewarded professionally or whatever it is? Whose opinion of us really counts for us? Who is it we're really worshipping? Who is it we're living for? And this passage is confronting us with a Jesus for whom the answer to all these questions matters, because he is passionate about God getting the proper worship and glory that he deserves. But this passion of Jesus Christ, predictably, it didn't go down very well with those around him, as it doesn't today. And in that sense, this passion or zeal went on to literally consume him. There's actually a deliberate wordplay in that word consume in verse 17 in the original. And John underlines it by changing the quotation from the past tense, zeal for your house has consumed me, in Psalm 69, to the future tense here, zeal for your house will consume me, in verse 17. So John's pointing out to us the inevitable outcome of Jesus' zeal, namely that he's going to be consumed by his enemies at his execution. So right from the outset, John is showing us that Jesus Christ is on a collision course with the human race. So we read in chapter 1, verse 11, he came to his own and his own people did not receive him. So as we thought about on Good Friday, there only ever was going to be one outcome when God came to the human race. It was inevitable that as soon as we got the chance, we would kill him. And that's exactly what happened. So for all our supposed tolerance, the one we cannot tolerate as a race is our own creator, the one who demands and deserves true worship from us. You're not the boss of me. No one has the right to tell me what to do. And this kind of insistence on autonomy at all costs, it runs very deep within us. And Jesus' experience reveals that the human heart is by nature God-killing. Our problem really is that serious. But as this passage goes on to show, Jesus' death is not the end of the story. Obviously, God cannot be disposed of that easily. And it's all because Jesus doesn't simply have a consuming passion, but he has divine authority. Now, the people around Jesus respond to this outburst, as I guess lots of us would, by questioning Jesus' authority. What right have you got to tell us how to worship? Verse 18, so the Jews said to him, what sign do you show us for doing these things? Now, Jesus has already implied exactly where his authority comes from when he referred to the temple as my Father's house. So his authority comes from his divine identity as God's son. But the people around him want him to prove it. And Jesus gives us this unexpected and fascinating answer. Verse 19, Jesus answered them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. The Jews then said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and will you raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking about the temple of his body. So Jesus is saying, if you want proof of my right to do this, my legitimate authority to demand true worship, if you want proof of my identity, destroy this temple, i.e. destroy me, as I know you're going to, and you will see that I have divine authority to rise again after 3 days. That is the proof. So do you see the significance of what Jesus is saying here? So when we ask the question, who has the right to tell me what to do or how to live? The answer comes back very clearly. Jesus Christ does. Jesus Christ, the divine creator, has the right to tell you and me and everyone on the wharf and everyone in Westminster and everyone in Libya what to do and how to live and what to treasure and delight in and what to believe. Jesus Christ has divine authority as the one who made us and owns us, just as any artist has rights over his or her creation, or just as any owner has rights over his or her property. And we say, prove it. And Jesus Christ says, my resurrection proves it once and for all. I uniquely have authority to lay down my life and authority to take it up again. And that is the definitive proof. Now, I'm guessing this news might be a bit of a shock for some people in this room. Perhaps this isn't exactly what you were expecting to hear on a Sunday afternoon. But actually, if you are looking into these things and you've got all kinds of questions buzzing around, this tells us what the shortcut is to investigating the truth. Find the answer to one question: did Jesus rise from the dead? And all the other questions will slot into place. So the whole of Christianity stands or falls on the fact of the resurrection. The Apostle Paul says, if Christ was not raised, the whole thing's a lie and a waste of time. You see, everything rests on this one event. So can I encourage you, if this is new to you, to grab one of the Gospels, those John's Gospels there on the table at the back. Get into one of these eyewitness accounts which detail the evidence for the resurrection, the predictions that it would happen, both from the Old Testament and from Jesus' lips, the empty tomb, the crowds of people Jesus appeared to after he had risen, and find the answer to the question, did Jesus really rise from the dead? Can any other alternative explanation explain what happened to that early community better than this conclusion? And if he did rise, everything else slots into place. This is the sign that Jesus has given us for confirming his divine authority. And the resurrection is very significant, not simply because it confirms Jesus' divine authority, which it does, but also because through it, there on the sheets, through it, the Son enables true worship. So we've heard that Jesus was on a mission to establish true worship of God, but that this mission would cost him his life, it would consume him. So did Jesus' mission fail? When Jesus was killed, it looked like the proud human boast that no one has the right to tell me what to do had actually been proved right. It must have looked to everyone like humanity had beaten its creator and that Jesus' mission had failed. But actually, when the Jewish establishment succeeded in destroying Jesus, as Jesus predicted that they would in verse 19, the irony is that they effectively succeeded in destroying their own temple. Because in AD 70, as Jesus predicts elsewhere, God confirmed Jesus' condemnation on the nation's corrupt temple worship, and the Jerusalem temple was finally destroyed, as it remains today. And the wonderful news is that Jesus' mission to establish true worship of God didn't fail, because he didn't stay dead. And by rising from the dead, he, in his own resurrected body, has replaced the temple as the place to meet with God and the place to offer true worship. That's what Jesus was referring to in verse 19. So do you remember, those around Jesus accused him of storming in like he owned the place. And Jesus says, own it. I am it. I don't own the temple. I am the temple. If you want to know where God really dwells, look at me. If you want to know where sacrifices of atonement really happen, look at me. If you want to truly worship God, soon you won't do it here on the Temple Mount at all. Soon all true worship will happen only through me. I, through my death and resurrection, am replacing all that the temple is and stands for. Now, Jerusalem is a fascinating place to worship. In fact, I think the Andrews went last autumn and had a fabulous time, so do ask them about it. But Jerusalem is not a special place to meet with God anymore, as Marcus was saying. Jesus is that special place. And through his death and resurrection, Jesus has enabled what people had previously never managed to do. So through his resurrection, Jesus has created a new people, a new Israel. In fact, a new humanity who at last are enabled to do what humanity and Israel were called to do, but never managed. That is to worship God truly. This is the point of the comment John makes there in verse 22. When, therefore, Jesus was raised from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this, and they believed the scripture and the word that Jesus had spoken. Now, even though as he stands there right in front of them, Jesus is calling people there and then to worship God truly. That's what he stormed into the temple to do. It's going to take the cross and the resurrection before even his disciples are enabled to have true faith and to become true worshippers of God. So in chapter 1, verse 14, which was our theme verse, John has already told us that Jesus is God dwelling, or literally tabernacling amongst us. Jesus, as he stands there in front of them, already is God's dwelling place, the temple. But do you see, that is not enough. Our problem runs so much deeper than that. So for you and me to become true worshippers of God, it doesn't just take God to pitch up on earth and to reveal himself to us. We sometimes think like that, don't we? If only I could see God, then I would believe, or then I would be wholehearted. But our natural hatred of God is so great that a greater revelation of him actually provokes a greater antagonism against him. That is exactly what we see in the life of Jesus. And in fact, there may be people here this afternoon who, even as you hear today about Jesus' authority over you, you can feel in yourself this desire to get rid of him. And that is our natural sin sickness. That is just how helpless we are. And it is only through the cross and resurrection of Jesus Christ that you and I can be remade, reborn, healed inside of this self-destructive God intolerance, this perverse insistence that we have on autonomy at all costs. And at last, we can be enabled to be what we were made to be, true worshippers of our glorious Creator. Now, we've got a little break now from John's Gospel, I think until July. But when we revisit the next section, we will be considering this whole issue of what it means to be remade, being born again, which is what Jesus says we so desperately need. But for now, each of us here, we need to recognize there is someone who is the boss of me. There is someone who has the right to tell you and me what to do. And by rising from the dead, he has not only proved the point, but wonderfully, he has enabled us to do what we could never have done before and become true worshippers of God. So let's devote ourselves to wholehearted worship of our Creator, because he's worthy. Let's pray.